What is Catholic masculinity? What does it mean to be a man? We'll talk about that today on Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Just want to encourage people to like and subscribe to the podcast, wherever you listen to it, wherever you watch it. I'd appreciate it. Also, follow us on all the various social media sites at Crisis Mag, and you can donate to Crisis Magazine. Just go to crisismagazine.com/support. Okay, today we have Kennedy Hall. He is our first-time three-peat guest here on Crisis Point. So you're beating Peter Kwasniewski by about a week, because he's going to be on, I think, next week, his third time as well. So he is the author of a couple books, including Terror of Demons, Reclaiming Traditional Catholic Masculinity, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. He's the host of the conservative talk radio show The Kennedy Profession on the Crusade Channel. Great show. He regularly writes for Crisis, and he's a contributing editor to 1 Peter 5. So, Kennedy, you have to have a beard to be a real man, right?
Yeah, you do. I'll update that bio, too. I had to take time away from the radio show for family reasons, but everyone should still check out the Crusade Channel because it's a wonderful place. But I work for LifeSite News full-time now.
Okay, great. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. And I do have my own YouTube channel I started called The Kennedy Report. So I resurrected an old show. It's doing pretty well. And anyway, so if you want to hear controversial takes that make everyone upset, but you agree with, you can check that out at The Kennedy Report on YouTube. And what Peter Kwasniewski makes up has more of me, more than me in spades, is intelligence, although I do make up for that by having more beard than him. So that
that's right,
works.
Exactly. Yeah. And we are kidding everybody. You don't have to have a beard to be a real man. But yeah, thank you. I copied your bio from the last time, and I shouldn't think to ask. So, but great. Okay, so LifeSite News is where we're going to find a lot of your writing, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, great. And Crisis. He writes for Crisis as well regularly. And 1 Peter 5. And then the Kennedy Report on YouTube, right?
That's right.
Okay, I'll make sure I'll link to that in the show notes so that people can find it easily. I'm sure if they just search on Kennedy Report, they'll probably find it. But we'll do that as well. Okay, so first, I just want to ask a little bit about like your background growing up. What did you, how were the roles of men and women presented to you in your upbringing? Because I think this really defines a lot of people, how they see their father and their mother in their own life. And how was that for you?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up, in your sort of average North American family, divorce, broken home, that sort of thing. None of this is to criticize my parents, but it just, it is what it was. So from a young age, you know, I had a stepdad for a while and stuff, and, you know, all the things that come with that sort of broken family. And from a young age, I was always very, I guess the word is curious about what a man should be. Oh, someone's trying to walk in my office here.
Guys, I'm on a call. Go, please.
See, he is actually a father.
Yeah, it's my three-year-old. My two-year-old. No, he's not three yet. Anyway, you just can't train two-year-olds anymore to understand working from home. So I was always curious about sort of what a man was going to be, just naturally. It wasn't like something presented to me from some role model. It was just, I'm a man, or we'll be a man. What should that be? When I was a young kid, it manifested itself a lot in feats of strength. You know, it still does. I love weightlifting still. But not that everyone has to, but that was just sort of, for me, that was clearly like a man thing, you know? So I tried to do that from a young age. And so when I was a teenager, I had some really great role models as football coaches. I actually talk about them in the book, in the introduction. And I don't know. I just, from as far back as I can remember, I saw the men that I respected the most were leaders. They sort of commanded a presence of respect, but because they themselves worked harder than everybody. So, you know, I had this one coach, Mr. Mike Stracelli. He's just, you know, for football here in this part of Ontario, he's kind of a legend. He's won a bunch of county and state or province championships and things like that. And he was a wonderful man. And he said to me once, he said, Kennedy, if I'm not outworking the players, then there's a problem. And he meant that. I mean, during the football season, he would sleep like 4 hours a night. We watched film all the time. You know, it was like being in a preparatory, you know, NCAA prep school, but at a publicly funded Catholic school, because he just decided to do all of that extra work for free. So that was kind of one of the reasons why I wanted to take that question of what a man is so seriously, because I saw a man like him who was exceptional in his duties and his responsibilities. And the fruits of that was obvious. You know, people respected him, but people were made better under him. His family respected him. His wife respected him. He was just sort of all around. And I wanted to sort of get to the heart of that. And when I discovered the faith, or rediscovered it, I guess, then it took a new dimension.
Okay. So how then would you define masculinity? Because, I mean, just this week, the nominee for the Supreme Court couldn't even say what a woman is. So we probably should have our definitions here. So what would you say masculinity, what does that mean?
Sure. So the word for man in Latin is vir, okay? And the word for strength is strength or virtue is virtu, which is, you know, so etymologically speaking, to be manly is to be virtuous. That's what the language tells us. In fact, you'll find in older writings, you'll find things like so-and-so acted manfully in a certain situation. And they could say it about a woman or a child. It just means acting virtuously. So as far as masculinity, for example, versus femininity, masculinity is a perfection of the male, okay? It doesn't mean you are a man or you're not a man if you're not masculine. It's a metaphysical perfection when it comes to our character. That being said, there is a natural sort of masculine and feminine thing we see in society. For example, if you were to look at a landscape and you saw very jagged mountains, you might say there's a very masculine quality to that landscape, versus if you saw a meadow or something, you might say it's more of a feminine quality. And you'd see this with how you decorate, you know, a little boy's room versus a little girl's room. It just sort of naturally happen. You know, it's funny, even in this world of gender confusion, one of the other things that's so common is gender reveals, you know, and everything's blue, everything's pink, you know, when we're finding out if you're having a boy or girl. So we know this is a very natural thing. Of course, the postmodernists would call it a construct, but I don't know. I think postmodernism is a social construct. But anyway, so masculinity, as far as what it means as characteristics of males, would be a virtuous perfection. So all men who are masculine are males, but not all males are masculine. Sort of like that old syllogism from Aristotle, all men are mortals, but not all mortals are men, you know. Right. So it can be applied to males, but not necessarily all males have it.
Okay, so if we say masculinity is being virtuous, how then, you know, then is femininity, obviously we're not saying women should not be virtuous, mm-hmm. obviously. So what then is, if we say that, what is femininity then? How is that different? And yet, obviously, it's still a call to virtue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know, it's politically incorrect, but you know, we need to look to scripture. And, you know, personally, I believe Genesis is a little literal history. So man is created first. Okay. So we have to go back to the original sin. And I do this in the book. And the reason why the word man is tightly linked to the word strength or virtue is because to be virtuous, there is a certain resistance, a show of strength that is necessary to do so at all. This applies to both men and women. But what we see in the creation is that man comes first, and he's given certain responsibilities. Basically, he's called to be a servant leader. That's basically what he is. And Christ shows us that perfectly, where he leads the whole human race by serving the whole human race. You know, the last will be first, the first will be last. It's this paradox of being a Christian. And when we go back to the original sin, what we find is that original sin we give to Adam, even though it was Eve who took of the fruit first, because there's an automatic failure on behalf of Adam in the sense where he resisted, he did not resist manfully or enough the temptation to do something and partake in sin that his wife had offered him. Okay. And this is why, you know, he has the greater sin in a sense, kind of like what Christ says to Pilate. So it's not that men and women both aren't virtuous. Of course they are. But it's just in the order of creation that God has ordained it to be. There is this primary responsibility that is put on men's shoulders to demonstrate this and to be an example. And you know, the analogy that I use all the time is to go back. I love using sports analogies, but, you know, the captain of your team doesn't necessarily have to be the best player. He doesn't have to score the most goals or baskets or whatever. But his role is to lead the team in a way that facilitates everybody else's ability to thrive so they can be better at what they are. Okay. And same thing for a coach. So he works hard. He should work harder than everybody else. He should be competent in everything, but it's more of the overall vision that he has and the way to facilitate everyone's thriving. So if we look at men who demonstrate this in their families, roles between men and women can be, they can change depending on technology and work. And I mean, these things are a little bit contextual, but nonetheless, there is a certain stability and a rock, a foundation that the man can offer in the household that is unique to him. So I think that's why, of course, both men and women are virtuous, but there's a primary impetus to it from the masculine creation.
So talking about roles in the family, I think that's where we get our major controversies, because obviously in today's world, the standard view is that there are no really distinct masculine or feminine roles in a family, that they're essentially interchangeable. And that's why, of course, we also, you can have, you know, you can have two daddies, you can have, you know, the gay marriage and things like that. But what would you say then is fundamentally, and, but you mentioned that that roles can change over, you know, depending on culture, technology, different things. What would you say then is the fundamental role that can't change for a man in his family?
Well, the fundamental one, I would say, well, we should put it two ways. People can choose to change the roles however they want, and that'll be either effective or ineffective. So, you know, you could like the Lutheran Church, you could choose to have a female pastor, but it's an absolute disaster. Okay. So I guess go at it, do whatever you want, but you're going to reap the consequences. But as far as the things that have to remain constant in order that things are ordered and people thrive, then that's a different conversation. So I would say primarily the father has to be, the man has to be the, what's the term in the New Testament? The catechon, you know, the thing that stops the Antichrist. You have to be the catechon in your family insofar as you are the spiritual head of your family. Now, of course, you could be incapacitated because you're injured or in a coma or something. Okay, these are the exceptions, but these exceptions prove the rules, just the way we see everything in life, you know. Now, as far as roles that can change, the reality is that, and this we can probably transition into this as well. You know, we live in a disordered time in history. Just it's well beyond order. Okay. So yesterday I was talking to my wife about, there's a book, I'm going to mess up the name, but I believe it's called Counsels of Perfection for the Christian Mother. It's quite a good book. I think Sophia publishes it. I don't know. It's actually kind of like Terror of Demons for Women. She found it. Some ladies she knows have been reading. It's great. And it makes the distinction between an imperfection, a venial sin, and a mortal sin. So an imperfection is something like where you don't have a virtue cultivated. So the analogy was, if you walk by a homeless person and you feel no desire to help that person. I don't want to get too social justice-y here, but you know what I mean? If you see it and you're not moved by it at all, you're missing a certain perfection, because we are called to love our neighbor, okay, and serve the poor and all that sort of stuff. As much as it's, you know, turned into the whole faith by the leftists, that is obviously a part of the faith. Whereas a venial sin would be, you know, you walk by a homeless man, you have the means to give him some money or do something or say hello or whatever, but out of a sort of hardness of heart, you decide not to. So you've intentionally made a decision to not do something, you know, you ought to do. That'd be the venial. And then mortal would be, I don't know, hitting him in the face or something when you ought to walk by or have something crazy. Okay. So what we have in this society is we have a very imperfect society. We have a society that's just completely disordered. Okay. So, you know, I'm 30, just turned 34 years old. I was just before 2 weeks of Slow the Spread, I was playing rugby and I was talking to this young man who was 20 or 21. And at that time, we were either expecting or just had our fourth child. And, you know, he said, oh man, it'd be great to have a big family, but you know, who can afford it? You know, he just kind of said it like that. He's 21 years old. I mean, he doesn't have any kids. He's not married. And I'm like, what do you, I'm a teacher and I'm fine. but it's just to illustrate that the concept of how to live in our society is just completely upside down. It's topsy turvy. It's a revolution. It's turned back against itself is what has happened. So we have to look at the roles of men and women in our society through, in my opinion, the lens of imperfection. And what I mean by that is we don't even know what perfection is supposed to be. So we have to start at that place and then work from there. And then, yeah, that's sort of the basics of it.
I remember when my first job, after I got married, I was 25 or something like that. And my wife and I were both working when we first got married. And then when we had our first child, which was like a year and a half later, I guess it was, she stopped working to stay at home with our oldest. And I remember I was talking to my boss at work about this, just how she's staying home. And he was saying, he was very sincere. He was not a believer or anything like that. He was very sincere. He said, boy, I wish I could do that. I wish I could afford to have my wife stay at home with my kid. I think he only had one at the time too. And I thought to myself, hold on a second. You're my boss. You make more than me. Mm-hmm. And so like, how is it that, I mean, here's the thing. It sincerely did not cross his mind. The wrongness of way of saying that, like, obviously if he made certain life decisions, he could. Like, I don't know his situation. Like, he might have had tons of student debt, he and his wife. I don't know anything like that. But the fact is that he just was immediate, like, I can't afford to do that. And I think that's an example of the imperfection you're talking about. And we were living out, this was in Washington, D.C. area, which is ridiculously expensive to live and stuff like that. But my wife and I had made decisions leading up to my child being born, before we were even married, that led to her ability to stay at home right from the beginning. But I think that's a big part of, I think what we're talking about here is these roles. Like, I remember when I was, I think it was marriage prep or something, somebody said that the role of the husband is the three P's: priest, protector, and provider. Mm-hmm. And the priest, he's the leader of the family in spiritual matters, particularly. He's the head. He's the priest of the family. He's the protector. It's his duty to make sure nothing happens bad to his, and obviously physically that's true. You protect if somebody came and invaded the house, it's to be the father, husband, should be the first one in the line of defense trying to stop it. But more importantly, spiritually, mm-hmm. he's protecting, he's not letting garbage come in through the internet or TV, whatever. But then the provider, I think that's the one where a lot of people have a problem today. And like, what does that mean? Like, for example, is I like the, you know, Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah, I love that show.
Ever. Are you telling me Ma wasn't providing as well? Yeah, I mean, she was. I mean, obviously Paul was in charge, but Mrs. Engels, I mean, she is working her tail off to provide in certain ways by helping out with the farming and everything like that. So where do we draw that line in 21st century Western countries of the provider of the family, the man or the woman staying at home and all those issues?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And this is the crux of the matter nowadays. Let's make up a fictitious couple and we'll sort of analyze their life. And they're Catholic. We're assuming we're talking about Catholics here who want to live virtuous. They want them and their children to go to heaven. That's prima facie. Okay. So if you're just an average person living in an average city with an average parish, right? And an average school, I mean, you have the basics available to you. Well, there's certain things you're going to have to say, okay, am I comfortable putting my children in a certain school? And if you're not, and you know that there are grave dangers there, and this is relative, you know, you could put your kids in an incredible Catholic school, and because they're around other human beings, something bad could happen, okay? But moral certainty, you know, my one of my priests explained it to me. He says moral certainty is all we can have, except for things like metaphysical certainty for mathematics. If I put a pizza in a room of 14-year-old boys who just got back from football practice, I will bet my mortgage that they'll eat it within 10 minutes. I have moral certainty that's going to happen. Okay, so we have moral certainty about certain things. I know if I put my kids in a certain school, it's very likely, if not certain, that they'll be shown pornography by someone's smartphone or something like that. Okay. So basically it's like, you have to look around at your life and you say, what are these matters where it's not just a matter of perfection. It's a matter of, am I or am I not sinning through omission or commission? Cause we just don't want to sin. Okay. So if you're a couple and you both make $50,000 a year, let's pick a number. Okay. And you know, you do that and you have a house that's a two-car garage and you've got two vehicles and you've got a timeshare and, you know, you are ish with your money. You know, you're not wasting all your money on Ponzi schemes, but at the same time, you're just like, oh, we'll keep the credit card low and that's all we care about. And you've got the newest smartphones and you've both got memberships to the golf course or the gym or whatever. You got all these things that just add up and you realize, wow, we've got a lot of creature comforts here. Eat out frequently, whatever. But you think to yourself, you'll be okay, we've had a kid, we're having a second kid, we're rosary praying Catholics, we are trying to be good Catholics, and oh my goodness, you know, so and so is at the nice little daycare right now with a nice old lady down the street and it's totally great. So and so's got to go to that school. We either have to move to a completely new state or county or province to find a good Catholic school, or we're going to have to homeschool. Now, the reason why you think why we have to is because you're thinking to yourself, I know by putting my kids in a certain circumstance that they will encounter something that will harm their soul. And that's my fault. Therefore, it's a sin. That's failing in that priestly role and protector as the father. So at that moment, you have to go from imperfections, i.e. we live in a disordered world with student debt and terrible marriage prep. Sounds like you had a decent one, though. We go from that to now it's a matter of heaven and hell. So now what do we do? So at that point, regardless of people's thoughts about how much a husband should provide or whatever, there's a decision you have to make that is vital. Okay, so that's where we should make that decision from. Because then now you can have a multiple different ways of attacking the decision. So it could be that you say, you know, you pick up a Dave Ramsey book or something like that, and you say, well, we've got $100,000 of debt and we could literally sell these three things and knock off 70,000 of it. And we could sell our car and knock off another 10 because we live close enough walking distance. And if you stay home, you don't need a car. And you follow these things out and you go, wow, if my wife comes home and starts homeschooling the children because we need to, because there's no other option. Okay. If my wife comes home and does this, really, we only need to replace $10,000 a year. Because after income tax and the cost of working and the vehicle, it's like, it's actually not that much different. You know, you can look at it like that. Then it becomes a more manageable problem. So if we go back to this analogy that you used with Ma and Pa and Little House, I read my kids those books all the time. You know, in the past, women were always working insofar as doing things that were useful as part of the providence of the family. This has always been the case. The worst thing that has ever happened, in my opinion, one of the worst things that's ever happened to this understanding of male-female roles in a marriage has been the 1950s stereotype of the housewife. You know, you read about this in when the West in Canada was being industrialized in the 1950s and 60s. Like Calgary is basically a city they made out of nothing. It was oil city. They just made a financial city because there was oil in Alberta. It's all new. It's all flat. It's all whatever. And there was this epidemic of alcoholism amongst housewives out there because they would move out there from Toronto and places in the East where they had culture and community and all this kind of stuff. They'd move out there to these beautiful, massive homes, all the latest technology. Husband was making $100,000 a year and he would come home at 6 o'clock and basically she didn't have to do anything. She didn't have anything to do. She could just drink. Okay. You know, so that's a stereotype of this arbitrary roles in the household. So what we see is, what is the constant in male-female relationships and marriage over time? The constant is those three P's you talked about. But it's not that the mom can't do anything besides watch the children. That would be absurd. It's the welfare of the children is the primary thing. And then everything else has to facilitate the welfare. And this goes back to the leadership of the husband. You don't have to make $200,000 a year to make sure that everything is hunky-dory. What you have to do is facilitate the situation. So maybe you have grandma who's close by, who's wonderful. Maybe your wife is a nurse and she works full-time and she wants to go down to working part-time. Well, grandma's great. She'll take the kids a couple nights a week or whatever. She works the night shift, or, you know, you work it out. And that's totally fine because you've made that work. But really, you know, to summarize, you have to put the welfare of your children first. And it is, in my opinion, sinful for a father to neglect to do that by a sin of commission or omission.
Yeah, I think there's a lot, the calculus involved in making these decisions. I think there's so many false assumptions,
yes,
or misunderstandings. Like, for example, my kid has to be on this soccer team, or my kid, you know, has to be at this good preschool or this school, or I have to have this, this level of house or whatever, or this, you know, I have to have two cars, whatever. All these assumptions we make. And I think honestly, the vast majority of people don't make those in some bad way. They're not like, not materialistic in the sense of they're just sinfully trying to get most for themselves. They just see this is what everybody does. And so this is what we're going to do. But I think what you're suggesting is take a step back, look at from, you know, 64,000 foot view and say, okay, what is actually, what is my goal? What is my goal here? What is my mission? My mission is to get my kids, to get me, my wife, and my kids to heaven.
That's right.
And so anything, and literally anything that stands in the way of that has to be eliminated as best as possible. Obviously, we live in a fallen world. It's impossible to get rid of it completely, but we do everything we can. And I think like one of the things like, okay, so my own philosophy is, and I've told my kids, I have six daughters and one son. I've told my son this explicitly, and I've said to my daughter as well, is that it's very important to me in my own marriage that my wife never feels like she has to work.
Right.
Like it's just, that's very important. Now, obviously I get disabled, something like that. Situations like that, we can't always control. But if I can help it, if it means I'm slinging burgers at McDonald's in the evening, I don't care. I don't want her to ever have to work. Does that mean though she can never do some work like from home and do something? Obviously not. Obviously not. It's just, we don't ever depend on that. Like I would never live off of that. And I think that's, and I told my son, do the same thing. You know, when you decide one day to get married, you have to have the same attitude. Don't ever make your wife feel like she has to work. But I knew that, but the truth is because I thought that from the beginning, when we first got engaged, like I said, we made all these decisions. Like one decision we made when we first got married, we both had jobs. And what we did was we took 100% of my wife's income and we put it towards paying off student debt. And we did not live off that at all because we knew, okay, once we had our first kid, whether it be in 9 months after the wedding or 9 years, whatever God decides, that we would be used to living on one income. And sure enough, it, you know, in God's providence, we literally made the last payment on our student debt the month before my first daughter was born.
Yeah.
My wife stopped working like a month before she was born or 2 months before she was born. That was when we made our last payment as well. So when my first daughter was born, we didn't have any student debt. And more importantly, we were used to living off of my income, which was modest at the time. I mean, you know, I was just out of college and everything. It, you know, it wasn't like some grandiose. I was a computer programmer, so it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't like it was.
You were on Wall Street or something.
Yeah, right. It was entry level. I mean, it was definitely entry level. So I think those are things where we get hung up, it seems to me today, on the whole issue of a wife working outside the home. And really the priority isn't that. The priority is what are you doing so your kids get to heaven and you get to heaven, right?
Yeah. And now we should say some hard truths as well though, because so I'm not very good at meditating. I'm supposed to meditate because I'm in the third order anyway, but I'm terrible at it and I'm trying to get better at it. So I'm reading The Soul of the Apostolate. Okay. That's what I was told. That's your boot camp for interior life. So I'm reading The Soul of the Apostolate and I'm very guilty of this. You know, everything in your life has to be animated by Christ. Okay. That's basic. Okay. Nice, fun words to say, but what does that mean? Excuse me. It means every single thing that you do, you have to put prayer before that thing in some capacity. John Henry Weston, who runs the LifeSite News, is incredible at this. He's extremely pious and earnest in his faith. And every single meeting you ever have with a guy, it starts with prayer. And every single day we have at LifeSite, it starts with a decade of the rosary. And it's very sincere. That's how he lives his life. And it's no joke. And there's a reason why Steve Jalcevic have been able to take such a difficult, I mean, talk about controversial. working at LifeSite. And, you know, there are people that hate us. And I don't know. I mean, you can only handle the stress if you have a prayer life like he does. That's the only possible way you could ever do it. Otherwise, to be honest, I think you become a nervous wreck. And so everything in our life has to be animated by a love for Christ, a love for souls. So that doesn't mean it's the same thing as a love for the church. And also, it doesn't mean that, let's say, we want to do good things for other souls, but we actually can't neglect the health of our own soul and those who are closest to us. That's primary, okay? So you know, I have, I mean, now I'm in a traditional setting, but for, you know, for a while I was in a conservative sort of charismatic setting. And let's be honest, a lot of great universities out there. There's a few good Catholic ones still. But it's a university where both men and women are going to. And universities educate young men and women to go into the workforce, relatively speaking. I mean, there's certain things you could do just for fun. You might go study Mariology or something like that because you just want to be an author and a mom or something. That's fine. But my point is I saw a lot of this stuff coming out of these places, and there was a justification of, well, here is the new Catholic way to have the work-life balance. And I would see a lot of young couples try to do this. And I'm and you know, and in my personal view is that it was an excuse to compromise on things that they wouldn't have otherwise compromised on. So what we have to do there is we have to say, okay, why do you want your wife to work? Or why is she saying that we need to do this because it's somehow a good thing to do? And this comes back to the perfection thing. With all respect, it's great to be a teacher. It's great to be a youth ministry leader. It's great to, I don't know, work in some kitschy Catholic graphic design firm or something like that. There's lots of things you could say, well, this is really good because I'm here, I'm working, I'm only working half time, but I'm making nice things, and they're spreading around Instagram and it's pictures of Mary. And it's like, okay, that's nice and everything, but you don't have to do that. And to be honest, you don't have a special charism that makes you infallibly impeccable at doing it. You just kind of are decent at graphic design. In reality, you probably should want to be home with your children, because that would be the perfection. And this is what the Council of Trent, the Catechism of the Council of Trent says. Some traditional Catholics take it too far and say, this means you have to stay at home or have to whatever. But it says a mother ought to, I'm paraphrasing, but should want to fulfill these roles. So, you know, we have to, this is like an examination of conscience. You have to do it for real. And you have to say, what areas am I justifying something that is less than ideal in order to do something that I prefer for me rather than what would be God's will for my life?
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's real challenging because what you're saying, because it really does go against the assumptions we all have, because I think like, I mean, the idea of women, like you're talking about going to university. Well, when you go to university, you pay a lot of money. And the purpose of it, like you said, is typically to get a job. Mm-hmm. And now, obviously, because of our imperfect society, women are and men are marrying much later in life. Just that's just what's happening because of our culture. Whereas in the past, I think a more healthy environment is when men and women were marrying much younger than they do now, like the average is like late 20s or something like that. Yeah. It should definitely, I think, be more healthy, early 20s at the very least. But like in my, it was funny because my wife was a feminist, then she was a Catholic feminist. And so then she's no longer a feminist, but I made, you know, I was saying, I told her, I wanted to always provide. She didn't have to work. I also made clear, I didn't want her to either. I didn't want her to work. And this is before, this is when we were dating. This is, you know, you don't want to say this 5 years. I mean, if you have a conversion, I understand, but you don't want to drop this on your wife 5 years into your marriage and, you know, and without any warning or anything. But, you know, we talked about this when we were dating. So she knew going in. But I do know that, you know, for her, like, you know, having a university degree, she, you know, she was political science and Russian studies and, you know, all this. She had her own dreams of a career when she was in college. But ultimately, for her, it was like, no, I want to take care of my kids. Like, she has this phrase, I'm going to butcher it, but she got it from somewhere else. But she likes to say where it's like, it, in the work world, she'd be, she'd offer like a little bit of herself to a lot of people. But with her kids, she offers her entire self to these few people. Yeah. Like, she gives literally everything to them. Now, of course, we're talking about masculinity and the male role, but my duty then, I would guess, is to make sure that happens, that mm-hmm. she can do that, that I do everything she can, everything I can, so that she can actually do that, give her entire life. Because, I mean, 24/7, she has no time off from being a mother. I don't have any time off from being a father, but she spends it directly with the kids, just about 24/7 with homeschooling them. So I think this is all like, but boy, when you go to university, you know, you're expected to get a job and to get a job for a while. I mean, you take 4 years, spend all that money. You're not going to want to work for a year and then quit. Mm-hmm. That's a hard thing to do.
Yeah. And, you know, in fairness too, you know, in this book, you know, I sort of beat up on men, including myself, But not because I'm just trying to be nasty. I also offer all the tools to better yourself and the inspirational stories and things. But we do need to take an honest account and say, I mean, why on earth would you want to be a stay-at-home mother in today's world with what a man is presented as? Because it's presented to you as he comes home, he wants supper on the table. Nothing wrong with having supper on the table. I'm just saying that's the extent of it. It's like you do all the things and he has a life of comfort because you provide it for him. That's basically what it's presented as. Okay. It's like the stereotypical sitcom situation. But that's, you know, it's only been the last 60, 70, 80 years where a man did not have to consistently do physical things in order to keep up his household. Both men and women have always been in that boat, you know. Laundry machines and sense of, you know, there was the spin ones with the, whatever, maybe 80 years ago, 100 years ago, but that wasn't a huge benefit. That was a little bit of help, you know. It was a physical thing until Maytag or whatever came out. And so, you know, there's always been this necessity that a husband has to be active in taking care of the house, taking care of the children, taking care of the providence for the family. And the wife was always, as the Bible says, a helpmate. They would do a lot of the same things together. There was a lot of natural collaboration. And, you know, this is something that's missing in our world today because the way that we work, we so often work far from the home. We're gone. And that's actually very modern, okay? That's really a thing that happened with the suburbs. Because, I mean, just logistically, think about the way that you would work in an old European city. So in the way that you'd live 150 years ago, you'd be working in a European city or a European-styled city, like an old colonial city in America or Canada or Mexico or wherever, where there is a complete organic relationship between everything, church, family life, business life, manufacturing. It was all there. It was all there, okay? Or you'd be out in the rural areas where the majority of people were, and there you had a very strong communitarian life because you had multi-generational living and you had, you know, your neighbor might have been a concession down the road, but you saw your neighbor every day and you could just literally drop your kids off there and it was normal. And your husband would be working either on the farm or if he was a tradesman, usually was a tradesman, a farmer, let's say in a blacksmith shop. Blacksmith shop was literally attached to your house or just on the same property. So there was never this massive separation between all the aspects of life, okay? And so that's something that we have to take account of as husbands and say, okay, if we're going to want to facilitate a more traditional lifestyle where everyone has the chance to thrive, then we also have to make changes in our life. You know, you can't say, I don't understand why she doesn't want to do this. You know, I make 100 grand a year. It's like, you're gone for 12 hours a day. And you're not only gone, you're in a different city for 12 hours a day. Farmers work lots, but they're in and out of the house 6-7 times a day. They say hi, they don't miss meals and so forth. But you're literally in a different world. It's nothing to do with the family. Then you come home and you come back into this world. And we live in different worlds for the majority of our time that we spend awake. So anyway, these are massive cultural issues to consider. But you know, it can't just be that you say, okay, now it's time to come home, sweetie. It has to be, okay, now what are we going to do with our family life to make this better for all of us?
So let's give a few practical bits of advice of exactly. First of all, I just want to mention the book, you know, obviously Terror of Demons. It's great. And I liked how there was a lot of talk about the cultivating virtue in the man's life, taming the horse. You mentioned, yeah. You talk about exercise, obviously doing everything you can to avoid pornography, the reduction of screens and smart devices, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But what would you say are maybe the top few bits of practical advice? Let's say it's a family where maybe it's both incomes, or at least the man's away and stuff like that a lot, and they're having some of these issues. What practical steps can a man take to take a more leadership role in his house, to have a more masculine role in what he's doing in the family? That doesn't necessarily mean moving out to a farm, you know, in another state.
Yeah. I don't live on a farm. I live in a tiny little village near farms, but I'm not a farmer. I work on the computer. I mean, I'm just like, I can't even fix my roof, you know, without a bunch of help, you know? So primary, let's just say you're starting off. Well, if you're starting off with absolutely nothing, like you've literally just discovered the faith and you have a secular marriage and things, well, then you're just going to have to go back to the basics and you just have to live in a state of grace And I've been there. We had a very secular marriage, and then I had the conversion. And the first and foremost thing for about a year was just, I went to Mass every Sunday. I prayed the rosary by myself. And we sort of, you know, I just was led by example. I started becoming a better person. So my wife said, well, this Catholic thing, you know, she's baptized, but we weren't practicing. This thing is working. So that's the primary thing. You're going to have to, wherever you're at, you might be, you know, it's funny though, if I think about it, I don't know of any, I can't think of anyone I know who has, and I'm going to use this term in the broad sense, a traditional piety. What I mean is, even if they're Novus Ordo attending Catholics or whatever, just morning, like a very old Catholic rhythmed way of a prayer life. I don't know a single person like that who doesn't have something like a traditional home life. It's almost like they go, you know, if the wife is the beating heart of the family, she's the hearth, the, you know, the hearth and home. If she's the beating heart of the family, then there's something about the, it's almost like the man creates the scaffolding, or I don't know if the right analogy, but he creates the framework or the infrastructure, and then she just naturally fits into that. So the first thing would be getting your own prayer life in order. Okay. Practical step is you can start leading the rosary. The nice thing about leading the rosary is trying to lead, what's the word I'm looking for? Not an inspirational prayer, but when you're praying off the top of your head, what do you call that?
Spontaneous.
There you go. So I don't do it very often. It's been a long time.
Like, you're a Protestant. I can't help it. You know?
It's been a long time since I was at like a praise and worship thing. When you're trying to lead prayer, the nice thing about the rosary is it's not awkward. You just say the prayers that everyone knows and you follow it. So first thing is the prayer. Now, the second thing, once you've come to the place where your heart has changed and you're in the position where you want to do this sort of thing, then you're going to have to take a stock of your life. And you've mentioned a book before that you read when you got married. There's more guys than this, but one of the guys I think is very helpful is Dave Ramsey. It helps that he's a Christian. He's not my theologian, but you know, he has a very practical and I think very measured approach to all these things. He offers very practical steps on how to get your financial life in order. And this does not mean become a millionaire. It means trim off all the excess, which is a very Christian thing. We've got to trim off the dead branches because the bad trees cannot bear good fruit. So, you know, you're going to take a look at financial life in your home, and you're going to say, to get our life the way we want it to be, whether that means stay at home, whether that means career transition, whether that means combination thereof, whether it means, okay, we got to find a Catholic school and you work part-time, whatever the thing is, you know, whatever you're going to do, you're going to have to make some changes. It'll be a little bit surgical. So you should have some guidance in doing so. More than I can offer in the next couple of minutes on the show, I would check out Dave Ramsey's works. I find them very helpful. And then after that, now you've kind of come into this new way of life. You're going to face other problems. Because you're going to be doing the right thing that God wants. So you're going to face lots of other problems from Satan. And that's always what happens. So there you're going to have to take it very seriously about how you continue to protect your home as you change this. You're going to find things that are so frustrating, like family members are all of a sudden going to think that you're a wacko. Been there doing that. You're going to find things, financial troubles will just surface. This is always the case when couples try to live a virtuous, pious Catholic life. All of a sudden, all of the cars break and the roof needs to be fixed. Like, it's without fail, okay? So you're going to have to rely more on God in these situations. And then from there, it's going to be a matter of consistency. You've made the situation, you've created the team, you've got the new playbook, and now you have to make sure that you don't fall back into bad habits, which means you're going to have to do a continual reassessment of things to make sure you're not falling into bad habits or even just complacency. And if I may grift the book for a second here,
please do.
Well, the reason I wrote this like this is there are about 10 chapters in here and all of them have different themes. So for example, let's just say you're facing a problem of your children are becoming a screen consuming age. There's a chapter in there on how to do media. Let's just say you're young, you know, your children are becoming at the age where pornography would be something that their friends they might meet, even in a good setting, would be into. There's a chapter on that. Let's just say, you're realizing as a father that you're just not physically up to the par and you're tired. You can't chase the kids around all day. There's a chapter on that. So I would say having this resource would also help you keep that fire lit and then something that you can go back to.
Right. So I thought the book is very practical. I really appreciate that it gives just it. but it's not afraid to say controversial things. At one point you say, like, throw away your phone if you have to, because if it's leading you to pornography or some type of sin like that, it's not worth it no matter what. You're willing to go there. You're not going to hold back. And so I really like that as well. One final question I did want to ask you is we can't have this conversation without bringing up St. Joseph, obviously, you know, terror demons. So what is the role of St. Joseph in all of this?
Sure. Well, it's funny. I did not write the book with St. Joseph in the forefront of my mind. And then I went on a retreat after I'd finished writing the book. And I realized it was in a chapel with a beautiful image of the Holy Family. And it was a silent retreat. So I was actually shutting up for once in my life and listening to God. And the word terror of demons just kept coming into my brain. And it was obvious to me that this book was modeled after the ideal Catholic man, and who was that Saint Joseph. So then after that, I went home and I wrote the appendix, which is all these devotions to Saint Joseph, which I think I'm quite proud of. And so we look at Saint Joseph as the model of our lives. And what is he? He's all the things I've described. He's facilitating a life of virtue and thriving. He's making the difficult decisions, like having to go to Egypt, which is like, I mean, you know, that was the last year, 2 years. I really was really scared what was going to happen to us in Canada with all the COVID stuff. I wasn't sure if I was going to have to. I figured out a route to get across the border. Let's put it that way. You know, it's funny, from the north. Everyone's always coming up from the south. I figured out the one from the north. And I figured it out in my mind. It was there. I said, I might have to do this. I might have a moment where I'll be in the middle of the night and I'll have a dream, metaphorically or really. And we'll have to leave, like Joseph had to take the Holy Family. I hope it doesn't happen, but I have to be prepared to do that because Joseph did that. You know, and he also died before his son went through his passion. And they call that the Passion of St. Joseph. So you also have to be prepared to facilitate the continual or perpetual thriving of your family, even if you die tomorrow, which practically means things like life insurance and debt. And I mean, that's the main thing in today's world, you know. You also have to be the leader, but at the same time in the background, because you're allowing everyone else to thrive. Again, it's like the coach. You're not on the ice. Everyone else is, but they're doing the best because of you. And if they took you out of the equation, they wouldn't thrive that way. And he never says any words in scripture, but obviously he would have spoken in real life and whatever. But that's the point, is it's not about his words, it's about his actions. So St. Joseph is and finally, I mean, God chose Joseph, not just to be betrothed to the mother of God, but to raise God. And if you really think, it's really crazy when you think about that, you know, I mean, we know Christ's two natures, but like in whatever, I'm not a theologian, but whatever the humanity of Christ was, Saint Joseph was the head of God's humanity. It's nuts. It's bananas. I can't even fathom the type of man you would have to be to not only be chosen to do that, but to actually do it. So develop a devotion to Saint Joseph, because he's literally the perfect example.
Yeah, I think we'll end with that, because you can't get any better than, frankly, modeling yourself after St. Joseph. Yeah. There's no better advice than that. So I just want to recommend everybody to check out this book, Terror of Demons, Reclaiming Traditional Catholic Masculinity by Kennedy Hall. It's from Tan Books. I will put a link to it in the show notes, and also to other ways you can find out about what Kennedy's up to. Unlike me, who didn't seem to remember at the beginning. So. Thanks a lot for being on the show, Kenny. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Okay, everybody. Until next time, God love you.